together to study your word. Thank you for the opportunity to be together. I do pray that you would just continue to guide us as we walk through this. Help us to see a picture, an accurate picture of who you are, your love for your people, and your desire for your name. Lord, just thank you for the privilege to be here together this morning. We ask this in your name. Amen. All right. Exodus 34. No, we finished 34 last week. We're moving on now. We're in 35. We're at 35 to the almost the end of the chapter, really, is the building of the tabernacle. It's been explained to Moses on the mountain. We've had him coming down, the golden calf incident, the covenant renewed. We did that last week. And now we're actually going to get to, starting at chapter 35, all the way through the end of 39, we're getting to the actual construction of the tabernacle. Is what's going to go on here. And so I think that what we'll do probably is move rather quickly through here because it's kind of not to suggest we shouldn't read it. We absolutely should read it, but it's kind of just the fulfilling of the tabernacle that was built the way it was said to be built. That's what's going on here. So We'll work our way, I think, rather quickly after we get past the first couple sections of chapter 35. Chapter 35 starts with this, after the covenant is renewed, Moses goes down. Remember, Moses comes down the mountain and doesn't realize this, but as he comes down the mountain, because he's met with God, his face is glowing and scares the people, and they say, hey, so he puts a veil on his face. And so that's happened. And then just after he gets back down, then there is, it almost feels like maybe it's out of place because they've gone through all this covenant renewal, all this stuff, and then chapter 35 verses 1 through 3 come, and it's restating the Sabbath regulations. It's a restatement of the Sabbath and the requirement for Israel to keep the Sabbath. He says, Moses assembled all the congregation of Israel and said to them, these are the things that the Lord has commanded you to do. 6 days work shall be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire in all of your dwelling places on the Sabbath day. So he comes down. They're getting ready to build this tabernacle, and he says once again, this is all the Lord has commanded you to do, and the one he picks out, the command he picks out to emphasize and hit again is not murder, not adultery, not anything except Sabbath. And it feels, you know, strange that he just hit the Sabbath. I think it's not strange at all. It's on purpose, because what are they going to be doing? They're going to be in this project of building the tabernacle. And you think, I know me, if I'm in the middle of any kind of a project, my push, my passion, my goal is just get it done and to work through. And it would be hard if I'm just about done. Here I am, the craftsman, making the cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant. I got one wing left. I got one wing left. And it hits Friday at 6 o'clock. And I think, 20 minutes I can have this thing done. What am I likely going to do? Take that 20 minutes and get the thing done. And I think that's exactly why God hits the Sabbath again here when he does. Because he wants him to recognize that no matter how close you are to having a project done, no matter how close you are to completing this, the Sabbath is important. Remember, the Sabbath stands as that thing that separates, the sign, really, of the covenant that God has with Israel. It's the covenant sign, not circumcision. Circumcision is the sign of the covenant with Abraham. The Sabbath is the sign of the covenant with Israel. That would stand for all our generations. And so I think God is even saying it's more important your heart of honoring me than it is your actions of getting things done. And I think that's important. I think that's important for all of us to understand. It was important for them to understand. He adds actually one more restriction to the Sabbath that he has not previously added. He's talked about the Sabbath before. He's talked about a lot of things in the Sabbath before. But now he adds actually the restriction of not kindling a fire in any of your homes. He adds that to the Sabbath as a restriction. And boy, I tell you what, there's a lot of discussion about this. And I didn't think it would be that big of a deal. But as you read about this, it's Some folks thought, some commentators say they were to have no fires at all in their house on the Sabbath, possibly. Some say, well, no, they could, as long as the fire was kept burning, it was fine to keep the fire burning. It was wrong to actually light the fire on the Sabbath. Because it doesn't say don't have a fire, it says don't kindle a fire. So then the question goes, so is carrying a piece of wood, picking it up and putting into the hearth or into whatever it is you're burning, is that work? Yeah, it would be, as defined by, later on, defined by the Pharisees, it would be defined as work. I don't know that God would have defined that as work. So I brought that up just to say I have no clue whether you could have a fire or not, as long as it was burning overnight. I don't know. But there are some who say, what's the official Jewish position, Ron? Do you know the official Pharisaical, rabbinical tradition on that? Can they have a fire on the Sabbath? Okay. Yeah, if you ever go to Israel, and it's the Sabbath, do not get on the Sabbath elevator. I'll just tell you that right now. They have elevators for Gentile people that you can push the floor and tell it which one to stop on. If you get on the Sabbath elevator, you are stopping at every floor because the buttons are out of service, and you get on and it stops at floor one. If you have a 27 floors hotel, you're stopping at all 27 floors, either on the way down or the way up, because you can't push the button. And that's exactly what... So there's an indication to me that the rabbinical tradition probably is a fire that was kept burning is okay, but a fire could not be started because they have lights on the Sabbath. There are lights on the Sabbath, but you can't flip a switch to get a light on the Sabbath. So that helped, believe it or not. It actually helped to have Ron contribute this morning. So, good. So, but that's new. That restriction is placed, the first time we see that restriction is right here in Exodus 35. That's the first time we've seen that added to the Sabbath restrictions. All right. That's the Sabbath. The next thing we move to then, once we get past that and the restatement of the Sabbath restrictions, is the actual building. But the first thing Moses does is he calls for an offering. Calls for an offering to the people. That's what chapter 35 starting at verse 4 all the way to the verse 29 is really him calling for and the people contributing to the construction of the tabernacle. And the people of Israel are, man, it seems to me they're so fickle. They either they're totally for God or they're totally against God. And this is one of those instances where they're totally for him because they give and they give and they give and they give. Let's read what Moses asked for. Moses said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, this is verse 4, "This is the thing that the Lord has commanded. Take from among you a contribution for the Lord, whoever is of a generous heart. Let him bring the Lord's contribution, gold, silver, and bronze, blue and purple and scarlet yarns, and fine twine linen, goat's hair, tanned ram skins and goat skins, acacia wood, oil for the lights, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, onyx stones and stones for setting in the ephod and for the breastplate." So he basically, and it's true, there was nothing ready to build for the tabernacle. There was no state treasury somewhere that they had. Moses didn't have a bunch of stuff that he could just put together and make a tabernacle. No, this had to be a gift from the people. I think it's interesting. There's something that's interesting here. This is not a compulsory gift. It wasn't a have to. It wasn't every person, every man from Israel has to give 10,000 shekels of whatever it was. That wasn't the case. This was a totally voluntary offering that was given by the people because it says whoever is of a generous heart, whoever has a desire to do this, whoever wants to give this to God. Well, these are the people who just a few days, about 40 days earlier, had said, we're throwing God off and we're going back to Egypt. We've totally disregarded him. So what kind of an offering do you think you'd get from that group of people? Probably not much. That's exactly not what happened. That's not what happened at all. In fact, when we get to chapter 36, verse 6, Moses has to say, stop giving. Wow, that would be wonderful to be a pastor, to stand up in front of a church and say, okay, folks, you're just giving too good. We're way beyond what we need to be. Just stop giving for a while. That would be really cool. I don't know that we'd ever do that, but it's amazing how if you're a budget follower, budget watcher, and you look at what God is providing for us through the people of Countryside right now, we're way above. And that's good. But you know what? I'm not going to stand up here and say, just stop giving for a month. That's great. Just quit. No, not going to do that. But Moses actually says, stop. We've got everything we need. We don't need any more for this. You got to stop. And that's 36 verse 6, just so you know I'm not making that up. So Moses gave a command, and the word was proclaimed throughout the camp, let no man or woman do anything more for the contribution for the sanctuary. So the people actually, it's a neat way to describe it. The people actually restrained from giving. They actually pulled back because they were having such a fun time giving. They pulled back and restrained themselves from giving anymore because the material was sufficient to do all the work and more. So there's actually more than necessary to do this. So they gave a lot of stuff. But they didn't just give stuff. They gave effort. It goes beyond just stuff. The first, verse 4 to verse 9 is the stuff request. Verse 10 starts the self request or the effort request, because he says, let every skillful craftsman among you come and make all that the Lord has commanded. The tabernacle, its tent, its covering, its hooks, its frames, its bars, its pillars, its bases. The ark with its poles, the mercy seat, and the veil of the screen, the table with its poles, and so on and so on and so forth. You can read. So basically what he says is, and not only do you give, anybody with a generous heart give, but anybody who has any kind of skill as a craftsman, come and help. And I think he states this on purpose, the way he's doing it, because there's a lot of stuff that has to get made. This isn't just let's throw a tent together and let's move on. No, this is an extremely difficult and time-consuming and hard project that was going to require a lot of personal time and input. So he calls not only for stuff, but he calls for commitment of people and help. Yeah, Ron? Okay. Start a fire for you. Okay. So there's the official answer. Right now, rabbis teach it's okay. If you've got somebody who's going to be sick or die because they're getting cold, you can have someone start a fire for you or keep a fire going. But if not, you're supposed to just protect yourself from cold in any other way. Okay. Okay, so you can let your thermostat light your lamp, but you can't do it yourself. All right, good, thanks, Ron. So anyway, he goes and says, this is what you need. I need your stuff, and I need your effort. And that's what God asked for. God through Moses asked for their stuff, and he asked for their effort. So that's the ask. The stuff, all this fancy stuff, gold, linen, goat skins, all this stuff, and all this effort to build everything that's listed in that long list of things that needed to be built. So how did the people respond? Well, verse 20 says how they responded. Then all the congregation of the people of Israel departed from the presence of Moses, and they came everyone whose heart had stirred him, and everyone whose spirit moved him, and brought the Lord's contribution to be used for the tent of meeting and for all its service of holy garments. And so they went home. Apparently there was this stirring, there was this movement, there was this change of heart inside of them that I think God reckoned, that God accomplished. And as he accomplished that, then what did they do? They came, both men and women, all who were of a willing heart, and brought brooches and earrings and signet rings and armlets and all sorts of gold objects, every man dedicating an offering of gold to the Lord. And everyone who possessed blue or purple or scarlet yarns of fine linen or goat's hair or tan ramskins or goatskins brought them. Everyone who could make a contribution of silver or bronze brought it as the Lord's contribution. And everyone who possessed acacia wood of any use in the work brought it. And every skillful woman spun her with her hands. And they brought, and they all brought what they had spun in blue and purple and scarlet yarns and fine twined linen. All the women whose hearts stirred them to use their skill spun the goat's hair. And the leaders brought onyx stones and stones to be set for the ephod, for the breastpiece, the spices, the oil, etc., etc., so forth. So basically everything that was asked, God moved in them, and they accomplished, they just gave. They gave. It was, if you remember the golden calf incident, Moses told them where to get the gold and what gold to take. He said, I meant Aaron. Aaron told them what gold to get. If you have earrings, take them out and give them to me. That's what he asked for. That's not the ask that Moses asks. Moses says, if you have anything, all these things, give it wherever it comes. And the people went home and came back and brought this huge contribution, just laid it at his feet, a contribution big enough to accomplish the task and more. It was a great gift that they brought. And so now we have from nothing to build the tabernacle to everything necessary to build the tabernacle and more than was necessary. So it was a big offering. It was a give it all Saturday is what it was. It was everybody giving everything. Not only did they give everything they had, but they actually went out and made stuff to give. Because those who were skillful at spinning spun the stuff they needed. And so there was actually effort even in the gift. It wasn't just giving what was easy or giving what was extra. It was giving, really giving everything. It was an amazing gift they gave. Where did they get it? They got it from Egypt. So it's interesting that the plunder they took in Egypt, God had already had a purpose for that plunder. That plunder was purposed to build the tabernacle. So it wasn't all designed just to make Israel a rich, individuals rich in Israel. It was designed for a purpose, and they yielded themselves to that purpose to see the tabernacle built. So that was the gift, and again, like I said, in verse 36, chapter 36, verses 6 and 7, the gift was so abundant that they had to be told to stop bringing gifts. So that was the gift, or the offering for the tabernacle. Chapter 36, actually we start at chapter 35, verse 30, we have then the beginning of the construction of the tabernacle. It's going to get started to get put together. But in 36, he starts talking about the craftsmen again. Moses is told on the mountain, remember, God has especially equipped these two guys, Bezalel and Aholiab. He's especially equipped them to kind of oversee all of this construction project. But he didn't just equip them. He equipped actually every craftsman whom the Lord puts skill and intelligence. Like I said before, I believe this is the first example we have, besides Moses, of inspiration of God. And I believe that the craftsmen were specially inspired by God to accomplish this task, because it says here, because it's the Lord who had put in their mind, given them intelligence to know how to do the work, and so that they could do it according to as he had commanded. This is important because again, there was no blueprint necessarily. There was no picture for them to follow. The only picture they had to follow was the description that Moses had given them from what he got from God on the mountain. He came down and said, okay, I want you to build an Ark of the Covenant. And I want on top of the Ark, I want these two cherubim things and with their wings touching. And it wasn't, they didn't then go away and say, okay, let's put together a prototype. We'll bring it back. Look at the prototype, Moses. Is this what you're looking at? Moses said, no. Make the feathers bigger, or the wings bigger. None of that happened. There wasn't a 4 or 5 step process. Moses said, here's what I want. And Bezalel and Aholiab and the craftsmen built it. First try. That doesn't happen in most ways things are built. It's never first try. Ask the architect, Chris, how many times have you ever taken somebody's concept, draw it out and say, oh, that's exactly it, Chris? Well, he's, you know, because he's inspired. Less than 1%. Well, here it is. Everything, every one of those things in the tabernacle that had been talked about, every one of those things was done the first time correctly. That's something special. That's something special. And I think it's something special not because they are really good craftsmen, something special because they were really well equipped by God to accomplish this. So the work of God in the hearts or in the minds of the craftsmen was important. And he's the one who gave them that skill. He's the one that set them up to do that. And so they took all the stuff that the people brought to Moses, and they started working. And then they sat and looked at it and said, no, that's too much. It's too much. We need to stop. We've got enough. So the offering stops. Then for the from chapter 36 all the way through chapter 39, really what you have is just the statement or the making of the thing that was supposed to be made. You have the making of the curtains and the frames, which is the outside, you know, the what built made the courtyard and the tent itself. You have the curtain and the frames and all the associated stuff that went with curtain and frames, posts, those kinds of things. Then you have the ark, the making of the ark. That starts chapter 37. The ark is made. And you can read that. I'll just tell you this, that when you read about the making, you'll see it's made exactly the way it was designed to be made on the mountain. It was exactly made. Remember, that is exactly what God said to Moses. See to it that you make it exactly according to the pattern that you saw in heaven, that pattern. And so this is to be an exact replica of the real tabernacle, of the real things that were seen by Moses on the mountain. And so he does that. You have the making of the ark. You have the making of the table of bread, the table of the bread of the presence, or some folks call it table of showbread. You have the making of the lampstand. Some folks call it candlestick, but since candles weren't invented until way, way, way late, this is probably a lampstand. Better answer. You have the altar of incense. You have the bronze altar, the brazen altar, or the altar for the burnt offering. You have the making of the court. Oh, no, the basin. I forgot the laver where the priests cleanse themselves, the bronze laver. You have the making of the court. And then finally, you have the making of the priestly garments in chapter 39. Again, the emphasis here is that everything was made the way it was supposed to be made. Starting at chapter 39, verse 32, you see how quick we went? We went through 3 chapters in like 2 minutes. That's amazing. That's impressive. That's something I would never do. And see, no hands are going up, so you're not going to stop me this morning. I'll tell you that right now. He says, thus all the work of the tabernacle, of the tent of meeting, was finished. And the people of Israel did according to all the Lord had commanded Moses, so they did. Then they brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent, all its utensils, its hooks, its frames, its bars, its pillars, and its bases. the covering of tanned ram skins and goat skins, the veil of the screen, the ark of the testimony with its poles, the mercy seat, the table with all its utensils, and the bread of the presence, the lampstand of pure gold and its lamps with the lamp set, all its utensils, the oil for the light, the golden altar, the anointing oil, the fragrance of incense, and the screen for the entrance to the tent, the bronze altar and its grating of bronze, its poles, its utensils, its basin, its stands, the hangings, the court, its pillars, its bases, the screen of the gate to those court and its cords, its pegs, all the utensils for the service of the tabernacle or the tent of meeting, the finely worked garments for the ministering in the holy place, the holy garments for Aaron the priest, the garments for his sons, the service of the priest. According to all the Lord had commanded Moses, so the people of Israel had done all the work. And they brought to Moses, and Moses said, oh, no, 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 go try it again. That's not what he said. Moses looks at it and says, and Moses saw all the work, and behold, they had done it as the Lord had commanded. So they had done it. Then Moses blessed them. So there's this massive construction project takes place, massive things going on, all that stuff done once and done exactly right, That's truly amazing. That's truly amazing that it happened that way. So they get it done, and now they're ready to put it up for the very first time. And that's what chapter 40 is. Chapter 40 is two major sections in chapter 40. First is the erecting of the tabernacle, building it, putting it up, putting it together. And then secondly is the dedication of, or the coming of the glory of the Lord into that place. That's what chapter 40 is about. So starting at chapter 40, verse 1, they actually built the thing. They put it up. The first day of the first month. So I think timing here is important. It's now the first day of the first month. So to me, that means they take their, and I'll probably, in a second you'll know whether I'm getting this right or not, because if I don't get this right, you know, hand's going to go up over here, and I'm going to have to say, okay, what? I believe they reckon their time from the time they leave Egypt, and now it is the first day of the first month. How long have they been out of Egypt? A year. I think. The way I'm doing math, I think it's a year. Because I think that's how they're reckoning time. And he's checking right now, so he'll get me in a second. But this is a significant day. It's not just, hey, let's throw it together now. There's a plan. It's let's put it together. Let's throw it up. We're building it now. The first day of the first month, they're now building the tabernacle. They're going to put it up the tent of meeting. And inside of that, they're going to put the Ark of the Testimony and everything that's going to go in it. They set it up. Who sets it up? The Levites set it up. That's their job. The job of the Levites is those that aren't from Aaron. Okay. There are Levites who are priests. Those are the descendants of Aaron. Those are the Levites that are priests. Every other Levite is not a priest, okay? But they are intended for and designed to be a part of temple worship or tabernacle worship. They were the ones who sung in the choir. They were the choir singers. They were the ones who played instruments. They were the ones who there was a group of them who tore down and built the tabernacle every time it moved. They were the ones who took care of the ashes that after everything was burned. They took them outside and got rid of the ashes. So you can think of it like this, and this is a really bad example probably, but while Aaron and his sons were the priests, like the pastors, the other Levites were like the deacons. They did all that deacon stuff. They did all that servant stuff. That's what their job was. They were the ones that would take care of all the stuff, moving it, putting it up, carrying it around. That was the job of the Levites. So that's what they did. Again, because they did not have an inheritance. It wasn't just the priests who didn't have an inheritance. It was the Levites who didn't have an inheritance. They were all chosen. They were all taken as something special for God because of the firstborn thing. When we get to Numbers, you'll see that all play itself out really well. So that's what they are doing. They take care of that. Again, I think key verse in chapter 40 is chapter 40, verse 16, where it says, "This Moses did according to all the Lord commanded him, so he did. In the first month, in the second year, on the first day of the month, the tabernacle was erected." That's another reason I think it's year number two. They've been out for a year. It's the first month of the second year, and it's day one. Okay? So they've been out a year. It's year two, day one. So they built it. He laid its bases, set up its frames, put on its poles, raised up its pillars, and basically he put up the tabernacle. So there it was. It was there, sitting there just exactly like God had said to put it up. And it would have been just another tent. It would have been just another fancy tent, very fancy tent, gold and silver and just really fancy furniture, really fancy stuff, if chapter 40, verse 34 and following doesn't happen. But chapter 40, verses 34 and following does happen. Something significant happens here, because then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So there's this coming of the glory of the Lord filling the tabernacle. What I think that's the dedication. That's when God says, "Yes, it's exactly as I designed it. It's exactly as you're supposed to do it. This is the place that I'm going to choose to make my dwelling with my people." That's what tabernacle means. That's what tabernacle means. Tabernacle means dwelling place. And so this becomes not just a fancy tent. It becomes not just a fancy tent with a lot of neat furniture inside of it. This becomes the dwelling place of God with his people on earth. From now until the temple's built. Until the temple's built by Solomon. So it's a significant period of time that the tabernacle serves as the dwelling place of God with his people on earth. Wherever this was, wherever the tabernacle was, as it was moving, especially once they got in the land, wherever the tabernacle was, that's where all of Israel, all of Israel's males 20 years and older, had to go three times a year to wherever this tabernacle was and meet directly with God in his presence and bring gifts and the sacrifices they needed to bring to keep those feasts. It's not just a few weeks that this thing served. It served for years and years and years as the dwelling place of God. This happens here. Okay, this happens here. When Solomon finishes his temple, it happens then too. When Solomon finishes his temple, he builds the temple, he gets it done, and there's the dedication day of the temple, and again there's smoke that fills the temple so that no one can go in to the place. And that is the presence of God, I think, coming to that place and saying, "Okay, no longer is it that tent that is my dwelling place. Now it is this temple that is my dwelling place." But he leaves. He leaves that place. He leaves that temple. And then that temple is destroyed. It's interesting. As you read through chronologically the Bible this year, you're going to find out that he actually leaves before the temple is destroyed. He doesn't wait for the temple to be destroyed and say, "Okay, I guess I got no place to live." He doesn't do that. He leaves before. You'll recognize significance of the name Ichabod later on. I'm not going to give it away. I want you to find it as you read through chronologically. But he leaves before it's destroyed. Then the temple's destroyed, right? In 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar comes against the Babylonians, come against Israel. This is their third time they've come against them. And in that time, Nebuchadnezzar's finally so sick of all the puppet kings he put in and all the rebellion and all of them trying to not get along with him that he says, "I'm done with his people," and he destroys the temple. Destroys it. It's said that not one stone left standing on another. He's so disgusted with the people in Jerusalem that it said he sowed the city with salt so nothing would grow. He tried to completely and totally devastate the city. He did that in 586 BC. in 516 BC, which is 70 years later, a new temple's done. A new temple is built. Now, they start building it in 536. They don't finish it until 516. It's called Zerubbabel's temple because he's the governor of the city in that time. Joshua is the high priest, not Joshua who led the people in the land, different Joshua altogether. It's a separate Joshua, but Joshua is the high priest. Zerubbabel is the governor, and he actually is in the kingly line of David, by the way. Zerubbabel is the governor. They establish that temple. They set it up. They pray to dedicate it, and no smoke comes. No smoke comes. Wow. So the glory of the Lord never came to that temple. Wrong! It came in the form of Jesus. It came in the form of Jesus. If you recall, maybe you don't recall because you haven't, but in the book of Haggai, Haggai is actually prophesying at the building of the second temple. That's when Haggai is prophesying. Just to give you a little bit of, this is a real quick history lesson, okay? In 536, Cyrus, the king of Persia, issues a decree saying that the Israelites can go back to their land and rebuild their temple. He issues his decree saying, go back to your land, rebuild your temple. So 2 million Jews leave Persian Babylon and head back to Israel. Wrong. 55,000 Jews. Of the over 2 million Jews that are probably alive, 55,000 of them go back to the land. And those 55,000, they get there and they're really excited about doing this work for God, and they lay the foundation of the tabernacle or the temple. They lay the foundation and they recognize, whew, this temple building is hard work. It's going to take us a while. It takes them 4 years to lay the foundation. So from 536 to 532, they're laying the foundation. It takes them 4 years. And then they start thinking, you know what? Well, if we're going to be here a while, we probably need to have a house. We probably need to have a place to live. So they start building their own houses, start taking care of themselves. And there's this pile of paneling over there that's supposed to be used for the temple. And they say, you know what? Hey, if it sits out here in the rain for another 3 years, it's just going to rot. Let's put it in our house. We can save it here in our house. So they steal the stuff that was supposed to be used for building the temple, and they put it in their own houses. They panel their own houses really, really nicely, make themselves nice places. The temple lays in ruins just as a foundation for years and years and years. And life starts getting hard again. The way Haggai says, yeah, you're earning wages and putting it in pockets with holes in them. You're making a lot of money, but as you're walking, it's all falling out of your pants pockets. You're working so hard to grow crops, and nothing's growing for you. Life is really getting hard for you. You wonder why? Because you're living in your paneled houses, and my house lies in ruins. My house lies in ruins. He basically says, you need to get back here. And so Zechariah and Haggai are prophesying right then. That's when they're prophesying. And they're saying to the people, get busy. Build the temple. And so the people build the temple. As they're just about done, there are some of the folks, I think the older folks, who had gone to Babylon and they came back. And they remembered Solomon's temple. They remembered what it looked like. And they looked at Zerubbabel's temple. And they said, oh, this thing we're building is the nasty little temple. This is awful. This is terrible. And they are mourning because of the awfulness of this temple, because there's no glory in this temple, is what they say. There's no glory in this temple. And there wasn't. If you compared Zerubbabel's temple to Solomon's temple, you would have said, there's no glory in that temple. And the fact is, there was no glory in that temple. The presence of the Lord, the presence of God, is never recorded to have come to that temple. So, Haggai says, yeah, it looks bad now, but let me tell you this, the glory of this temple will far exceed the glory of Solomon's temple. It'll far exceed the glory of Solomon's temple. How is that going to happen? I think it happens this way because the Son of God himself is going to walk into this temple. Whoa, no, 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 no. That is not true. Zerubbabel's temple is not Herod's temple. Oh, yes, it is. Same foundation, same original box, same original place. Herod just expands it. In about, 34 B.C., Herod the Great, you're going to get a real history lesson here. Herod the Great, because he is an Idumean. You know what an Idumean is? Where they descend from? Where did the Idumeans descend from? Do you have any idea? Esau, Edom, Idumean. So Herod is a descendant of Esau. Is a descendant of Esau ever supposed to be a king over a descendant of Jacob? Okay, I'm going to ask that question again. Hopefully you'll wake up this time. Is a descendant of Esau ever supposed to be a king over a descendant of Jacob? No, he's not supposed to be because I've loved Jacob. And the older will serve the younger, right? That's why I believe Mordecai wouldn't bow to, Haman, because Edomian, the same type thing going on. So in order to endear himself to the people that Rome has made him king over, Herod says, if I build them a new temple, they'll have to like me. They'll have to honor me as king. Well, he's really mistaken because he's a lunatic, first of all. He's a great builder, but he is whacked out crazy. Just read something about Herod. All of the Herods was lunatics. They were scared for a purpose because they wanted to kill each other. One Herod kills his brother and takes his wife. Doesn't like people bringing that up. He takes your head off if you bring it up. Ask John the Baptist. So he says, in order to endear himself to the people of Israel, he says, I'm going to build them a temple. I'm going to refurbish their temple. So he begins this construction project to refurbish Zerubbabel's temple. And that is the temple that's on that when Jesus comes. Now, it's not finished yet. History says that really, even when it was destroyed in 70 AD, it still wasn't done. All of the things that Herod wanted to do to it weren't finished yet when it was destroyed in 70 AD. It was a massive reconstruction project. But the base was Zerubbabel's base. It was Zerubbabel's temple. So there's actually two ways you could consider it more glorious. If Herod's temple, which was, that temple was one of the seven wonders of the world, I guess. It did become very glorious. But I don't think that's what Haggai has in mind. I think what Haggai has in mind is the very presence of God coming and walking in that temple. And that's what I think he had in mind. So you have that happening. So that's temple number two, Herod's temple, Zerubbabel's temple, temple number two. Then there is a temple that'll be built in the tribulation. There'll be a tribulation temple, and then there'll be a millennial temple. So four temples. I think there's a fifth temple, and it's in heaven. It's in heaven. It's the one Moses saw. It's the one that the author of Hebrews says is the one that everything else is patterned off of. And I think that's the one that'll be used in the eternal state. The new heaven and new earth, I think, will have that temple. So you're free to argue with me about that one, but not now because class is over. So if you were to ask me how many temples there are or will be, I think five. I think five temples. And I think, given time, I could make the case for each one of those five temples pretty well. But I'm not going to do it now. Ron, real quick. Oh.
Yep. 50 days after
Passover, yep. Yep. Good. I was right. Yay. It's getting late. So it's actually 9:45. I'm going to let you go, get your kids out of the nursery, take them where they need to be, and we'll see you here in a few minutes. Thanks for listening. Exodus is done. We're moving to Leviticus next week. And you're thinking, if you're reading through the book, reading through the Bible this year, you're thinking, how are we going to cover that? I'll tell you quickly. We're going to cover it quickly. So you're dismissed. Thanks. Bye.